Thing I want to ask you to do is everybody check your cellular devices. If you've got anything that vibrates, beeps, rings, tweets, twits, farts, whatever it does, turn it off. Please, please, please. That is a distraction to not only you, but also our speakers. So we appreciate that. Now, before we get going, if we could have a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. Afternoon's workshop is on living in sobriety. Each of our speakers will speak for 20 minutes, sharing their experience on this topic. CDs of this workshop and all the other speaker meetings will be available over here with Mountain Recordings, with Mike and Kathy. We appreciate them so much. Our speakers on the panel this afternoon are Mari from Canada, Don from the state of Washington, and y'all better hang on because Sheldon has arrived from Vegas. Like, literally just rolled up, because you know how them people in Vegas roll, right? Like, just, yeah. So, their topic is on living in sobriety, and they asked me, what does that mean? I said, I really don't know. So they're going to talk about their own interpretation of what that living in sobriety means. And I believe we're going to go ladies first and start with Mari. Oh, Sheldon's going first? Excuse me. We're going to start with Sheldon. Got you. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sheldon.
And it's great to be here. I came in on a red eye flight, and I haven't slept much, which means you're probably going to get the best talk I've ever given. if I know me. Living in sobriety. What a great huge broad topic. And I was thinking about it today as we were driving from the airport, and I was thinking, what does that really mean? If someone was to say to me, how do you live in sobriety? Or another way to ask that question would be, how do you live with sobriety? Because I'm a guy that suffers from this thing that starts when I stop drinking. I wish I had a disease where I drank too much and somebody said to me, quit drinking, you'll have no more problems. And then I quit drinking, and I had no more problems, right? But what happens to me when I quit drinking is that I get this emptiness inside me. It starts as this low-level kind of uncomfortability, this judgment, this, I don't know, I just kind of know what you're thinking, and you're never thinking nothing good, right? And I have this great talent. I have an amazing talent. I have the talent of getting 5 to 10% of the information and then making up the rest, right? And when I make up the rest, I never seem to make up love stories, right, where everybody lives happily ever after. I tend to get 5 or 10% of the information, and I write action, adventure, horror movies, right, where the star always dies at the end, right, and it's tragic and horrible. So I just have this propensity to look at the world through a vision, through a prism of where nobody likes me, it's boring, it sucks, you suck, it's all going to go wrong, and I have this natural disposition, this default position of low-level depression and angst. So when the question is asked, how do you live in sobriety? I suppose if when I'm new and I ask that question, what I'm really asking is, how do I deal with feeling like this all the time? And the answer is not a good answer, right? Because the answer to how do I deal with being sober is always the same, right? You guys, some of you have it running through your head right now. It's always, well, don't worry about living this way for the rest of your life, Sheldon. We're going to do this one day at a time, which isn't a good answer. Because to me, it doesn't sound like good news. It sounds like what you're saying is that I need to feel like this one day at a time. One long, miserable, painful 24-hour period at a time. Suffer slowly and have the decency to do it quietly. One day at a time. And if you say to somebody, one day at a time sounds like an awful long time, it doesn't get better, it gets worse. They say, then just do it 1 hour at a time, right? 60 painful minutes, right? I can hear the second hand, right? Tick, tick, tick. So what is it? What is it that has to happen for me and to me for me to be able to live in sobriety, for me to be able to be sober? You know, boy, not a long time. You know, I'm sitting next to heroes of mine that are sober much longer than I am, but I've been sober since 1996. I've been sober a little over 21 years, and for me, that's an awful long time to be sober. And I tell you, if it felt like that for 21 years, I wouldn't have been able to do it. There are people in AA, and you meet them from time to time, that are able to hang on to the pain, right? These are the guys that they're sober 8 or 9 years, or sometimes 25 years, and if you want what we have, you're rah, 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 and they're miserable as hell, right? And they're just like, I don't want what you have, I want to blow my brains out, right? Because they're not happy about being sober, they're not excited about life and sobriety. I'm not that guy. I'm the guy that went in and out and in and out. Because 8 or 10 days of feeling like that and I can't take it no more. 20 days of feeling like that and I need to change the way I feel. I got 30 days twice and I lied about 60 days once. And that was the sum total of my sobriety before I was able to get a hold of the program. So what is it that has to happen? Well, I suppose it starts with step three, right? We're kind of starting in the middle. It starts for me with step three. Step one and step two. Step one, I'm identifying the problem. Step two, I'm identifying the solution. The solution that we offer in Alcoholics Anonymous, unfortunately, if you're new, right, is a relationship with God, which I know how that sounds, but it's all we got, right? All right. Well, I mean, there's nothing else here, right? Other than, if you want what we have, goddammit, right? Other than that, right? There's nothing else here. So in step three, I make this decision that I'm going to try and live my life by spiritual principles, and I have no idea what that means. I have no idea what that means. And I write this list in four, and I share it in five, and I take a look at what my life looked like with me reacting to life the way I've been reacting to life. I take a look at what it looks like when I don't live by spiritual principles, when I react to my head telling me, you're thinking about me, you're talking about me, nobody likes me, there's no color in the world, it's bleak, it's painful, it's boring, on all the stuff that my head chatters, and I make this decision in step three that I'm going to ignore the noise in my head, and I'm going to act as if God's in charge and God's on my side. And then step four and five, I take a look at what it looks like when I don't do that, and I go, okay, in step six, I go, I'm going to try and live that way. And in step seven, I say this prayer and I ask God to take away all that angst, all that uncomfortability, all that what it feels like for Sheldon to be sober, which isn't good. All right, you come into AA and the guy at the podium goes, I'm sober 21 years and I'm so happy. And I'm thinking, bully for you, right? You suck. Right? But I make this decision in step six. I say, okay, I'm willing. In step three, I said, I'm willing to let God run my life. And in step six, I said, I'm willing not to react the way I reacted in four and five. And I'm going to try and give those reactions to God. So how does that relate to how I live in sobriety? Well, step six and seven are funny steps. I often joke, I'll probably mention it tonight. And if I do, laugh courteously as if you've never heard it before, if you would. But I'll often mention that we don't have to worry about six and seven because nobody really understands six and seven, right? Nobody knows what they mean. It's one paragraph in the book and, you know, when was the last time you sat with your sponsor on six and seven? Read it in the 12 and 12 and then we'll write your eight-step list. We just blow right past that thing, right? And why? Because it is in 10 and 11, and particularly in 11, that I get driven back into step six. It is through my continual making mistakes, but having the guiding principle that I am going to try and live by these spiritual ideals. By being willing to make mistakes, willing to fall short, like it says in our book, no one among us is able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints, but we are claiming spiritual progress. So when a guy that I sponsor calls me, and when I call my sponsor, he says the same thing to me, because there's nothing new under the sun in AA, right? We're just repeating what we've been told by the people that came before us. When a guy comes to me with a problem and he wants to talk to me about his boss, I tell him, this is great news, because we have an opportunity to practice spiritual principles. Well, that's not what I want to hear. I want to hear you agree with me that my boss is no good. But this is a great opportunity. Because if I'm going to live by spiritual principles begin when things stop going my way. It's easy to be love and tolerant and have great morals and moral convictions galore, right? It's easy to have forgiveness and compassion for people I like. But when things stop going my way, at what point am I willing to say, in no matter what problem I have, wait, I got to do AA on this. Wait, I got to do AA on this. I have conversations with my sponsor and guys that I sponsor where maybe as a sponsor you've had this experience. A guy wants to tell you incessantly about something. Maybe if you're a guy and you're sponsoring a guy, maybe he wants to talk incessantly about his girlfriend. You know what she said? You know what she did? Blah, 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 blah. And you give your best spiritual wisdom. Well, you need to find love and tolerance. Next day, same phone call. Next day, same call. The boss. Next day, same phone call. Next day, same call. The mom. Next day, same phone. And you seem like you're trapped in that movie Groundhog's Day, right? Every time the phone rings, it's like, oh, I wonder what mom said today. Hi, this is Sheldon, right? And you hear the same conversation over and over again. And at some point, we have to be willing to say this to ourselves. This is how I live in sobriety. I have to be willing to hear it from my sponsor, and I have to be willing to say it to the guys that I sponsor. We can talk about the problem as long as you like, but at some point, we have to do AA. At some point, we have to really live this program. At some point, we have to really look for how, if I was in their shoes, might I behave that way? We have to be willing to do that. This was our cost portion out of the fourth step. We have to be willing to say, I used to hate this one. My sponsor would say to me, well, Sheldon, let me ask you this. What would a spiritual guy do in this situation? Not you. Not you, Sheldon. But a guy with spiritual principles and God in his life that believed there was a power, not you, Sheldon, but a guy that believed there was a power behind him bigger than any problem in front of him, how would he behave in this situation? He used to play this trick on me. He'd say, next time you get any angst inside yourself, I want you to imagine there are two people in the room. I want you to imagine that me, your sponsor, is in the room with you. And I want you to imagine the newest new guy who you're trying to impress with your program commitment is in the room with you. And if your sponsor and the newest new guy were in the room with you, how would you behave? Well, I'm not doing that. I know what that looks like. I'm not doing that. But by trying to practice that and failing at that, and we fail at that miserably, why? Because we're human beings. Why? Because we're not saints. And this is an interesting question that I sometimes have. And if God loves me, which I'm sure he does, if God loves me, why would he allow me to get this angst and uncomfortability? If God loves me, why would he allow me to have problems in relationships? If God loves me, why would he allow me to struggle at work, struggle with my marriage, struggle with my parents, struggle with my friends, struggle with my AA group, struggle in life? Why would he allow me to feel this angst? I mean, if he loved me, you would think that he would just take all that away. And then I think to myself, when do I turn to God? It is in those moments of angst. If God, as Wilson talks about in the 12 and 12, were to leave me as pure as the driven snow, there are people in this room who are spiritual enough to hold gratitude for that in their soul and live their lives praising God for rendering them pure as the driven snow. I'm not one of them. As soon as I got comfortable and didn't have any more angst, I'd take credit for it. And I would stop turning towards God. Maybe the angst, maybe the difficulty in my life, maybe the problems in sobriety are in fact a gift from God. because they drive me back to Him. I was talking to my son. My son's now 15. He was 6 years old at the time. And I was trying to teach him a little bit about God. The little bit that I know, I was trying to teach him. And he says to me one day, as a six-year-old might, he says to me, "Dad, what's your favorite thing that God does for us?" And I thought about it for a minute. I said, "You know, I think it's sunsets and rainbows and the love that I feel for you and the beauty in the world and the love that I feel for your mom and laughter. I think laughter is one of the best gifts that God gives us, when you get that laugh that kind of, you know, you get the endorphins. I mean, it's just amazing. Maybe that's the best gift from God." And he sits back at 6 years old and he goes, "Yeah, maybe. Maybe, Dad, it's that, and maybe it's the fact that sometimes He gives you difficulties to go through so you'll turn to Him in prayer." I said, "Would you sponsor me?" Right? I mean, I love my sponsor, but he couldn't have come up with that, right? I mean, there's no way he'd have gone, "Yeah, it's the laughter for sure," you know? Right? So maybe this struggle that we have in life, this journey that we're on, this path that we're supposed to find, is a path of struggle that keeps us on the road towards God. And maybe my job living sober, maybe the way that I'm supposed to live sober, is I'm supposed to, as early as I can and as quickly as I can, I'm supposed to try and find these spiritual principles in any problem that I have. Now, I wish that what that meant was, when I get angry at someone, you know, I get that pause they talk about in AA. Right? Somebody came up with spiritual math that makes no sense to me. They said you get 1 second for every year, which means I'm supposed to pause 21 seconds, and that's on the best day, the best time, very rarely, never happens, right? But I wish that every time there was a problem that I was able to say spiritual principles. But the challenge that I really have is, how quickly can I remember that? How fast? Is it right now in the pause? Is it after I've yelled at you and said something I now have to make amends for and add amends to the practice of the spiritual principles? Is it 3 weeks? Is it 3 years? Is it when we've been separated in our relationship for 5 or 10 years and that relationship needs to be mended and now I'm willing to apply spiritual principles? But the question is, how fast am I willing to apply spiritual principles in my life so I can feel connected to you, and by being connected to you, be connected to God? And I think that each of our goals should be to try and make it faster than it is today, quicker than it was yesterday, and to always try and apply spiritual principles in every area of our life and not drift into that morbid warrior reflection, not beat ourselves up with the relationships that I've got a couple of them where, well, you know, eventually I'm going to be willing to apply those. It just ain't today, right? But it's on the agenda, baby, right? So not everybody, not perfectly, but as quickly as we can, as often as we can. The question has to be, is step 3 and step 6 in my relationships? And the more relationships that it is, the easier it is for me to live sober. Thanks for letting me share. Don't fight now. When the music stops, somebody will talk.
Sheldon said he's glad I didn't go first because I would have poisoned him. My name is Marion. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Sheldon. That was great.
I love you.
So living in sobriety. I started drinking at 25 and got sober when I was 40. Prior to starting drinking at age 25, I had, from I was age 13, I had suffered panic attacks, and just hadn't been very well mentally. I was very afraid of consciousness. I was very afraid of living in reality. It was very difficult for me. I was afraid of my own mind, to tell you the truth. That was a problem. I was very much afraid of my own mind. I was afraid of going insane. I was afraid of too much consciousness, you know. And the great fear I had was that one day I would die, and I would be in eternity with just a mind forever, a mind that never stopped working. So alcohol did many, 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 many things for me until eventually it did nothing for me. And I had 4 months sober, and I drank again. And I drank again, and I learned from the reason I drank. I didn't drink because I wasn't going to meetings. I drank because I'm one of those people that, because of the life I led, in order for me to live with any degree of consciousness on a daily basis, I would have to do a fourth and fifth very quickly, because I hated myself. I absolutely hated myself. So it was so shocking to me to come into reality that I had shingles. Living without alcohol was so traumatic for me, I developed shingles. And those shingles were good for me, because I realized too that the reason I had drank again was because I had a sponsor, and she told me not to do something. It was regarding my children. I won't get into it. She told me not to do it, and I did it, and I drank again. And what I learned was, even though when I was drunk, I phoned that sponsor and fired her, she knew what it was good for me better than I did. Because if I had done what she told me, I probably wouldn't have caused my son's pain and agony again, and I wouldn't have drank again. So it was a big lesson for me. And I am very fortunate too that some of the people I sobered up with in Edmonton, Alberta, were just as crazy as I was. We spoke openly about how difficult it was to wake up in the day, not wanting a drink, but thinking that you're going to go mad, thinking that it's impossible to get through the day without going completely off somewhere, dropping into that abyss. And being able to talk about that freely really helped me. And then the other thing is, when I sobered up, I shook a lot. I don't know anybody in here was a shaker, but I used to shake. And they used to take us to beginners meetings, and they used to have a place called Shaker's Row. And they put us all in the front seat, and we'd all sit and shake and tell funny stories. You know. And I remember one day I'm sitting there, and I had DTs. You know, and obviously some of these guys had DTs as well. I don't know if you've ever had DTs. It ain't funny. But so I'm sitting there, and it's a Saturday morning. We're telling goofy stories. The meeting's going to start. The meeting starts, and we're shaking, and we're full of hope. And the guy next to me looks up at the wall like that. And then the other guy looks up, and I think, what is it? And I see a big thing on the wall, right? But I don't know if it's really there. And I don't trust their judgment, right? And there was an old-timer behind me, and my sponsor was behind him. And my sponsor must have said something to Ernie, because Ernie tapped me on the shoulder. He said, it's really there. It's a big old horse fly. Right? And I learned to trust your judgment, right? I learned how to trust your judgment. The other thing was, living in sobriety, I hadn't slept for, I don't know, real sleep for many years. Real sleep. And so, like a lot of us, when I got sober, I couldn't sleep. You know, I used to call it the owl syndrome. Ooh, you know, you're up all night long, and it's a nightmare. Going through the night, if you haven't done your fourth and fifth, I did mine at 6 weeks sober. But going through the night with all of that in your head and you can't sleep, it is a hell on earth. And I didn't want to drink. God had relieved me from drinking. But again, I thought, this stuff in my head is going to drive me insane. And I remember to tell you how goofy we are, I remember sitting with some of these guys and they're saying, you know, can you sleep? No, I can't sleep. I can't sleep here. So what did you do? Well, what I did was, actually, I felt suicidal because I hadn't slept for like a week. And I really felt suicidal. I thought about killing myself. But then I remembered what I was told. So I ate 2 chocolate bars and called my sponsor and I was okay. And I thought, can you imagine if you went into work and your boss said, how did you feel last night? Well, I felt suicidal, but I had a couple of chocolate bars. And it was the realization that Bill's 2 words, a separate entity, most certainly applied. Me and Alcoholics of My Type, we are a separate entity. I needed other tools in the world rather than what normal people could give me. If I was around my family, they'd say, go to church every morning, go to the Catholic priest, talk to the priest. He doesn't understand, unless he's alcoholic, he doesn't understand the mindset I have. The other problem I had to overcome was going out. You know, I've said this before, hundreds of years ago, there was when they were drawing maps of the old world, and they didn't know all of the world. They only knew a little bit of the world. So they would draw the piece of the world that they knew, and then they would draw the ocean, and they would say, beyond this place there be dragons, because they don't know what's out there, right? Has to be horrible. Well, that's like me going out the door in the morning. Beyond this place there be dragons, called people, places and things. Okay, and I am not good out there in the world. I think I'm going to fall apart. I go into a mall and I get overcome with agoraphobia, or else I try and go in an elevator and I get claustrophobia. I mean, these are the things that I had to cope with. you know, all of my husbands used to say to me, you're not well, you know, and I thought, you don't know the half of it, right? You don't know what I try and cope with. This was how my alcoholism manifested. And it is because of a loving sponsor. And you know, I was told when I came in here, you don't know anything. You're not going to be allowed to talk for a year. You have to take the cotton batten out of your mouth and stick it out your ears and stuff it in your mouth. And I remember going to a meeting at 6 months sober, and I thought I had something of great intelligence because I have a high IQ. I mean, a lot of alcoholics have a high IQ. Al-Anon doesn't believe it, but it's true. But you see, it's a funny thing, IQs don't get you much, right? And I remember sitting and hearing this thing in a discussion group. And I put up my hand to the chairperson. I said, you know, I think. And he said, shut up. He said, who told you to think? Look where thinking got you. Right? And I realized this old timer had said to me that I love very deeply. He said, look. He said, you do what I told you. You stick the cotton batten in your mouth, take it out your ears. You learn how to listen. He said, you learn to take instruction. You learn to ask before you make any major decisions in your life. You do nothing without getting instruction. You respect the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You behave well. Are you able to do all of these things to save your life? And I said that I was. And I made that commitment. And it has never failed me. You see, I believed that I could not have walked through life the way I have, unmedicated, without the love and sponsorship I've had. Because the sponsors I've had and still have today are amazing. They understand my mind. They understand how I think. They don't laugh at me when I tell them some of the bizarre thoughts I have. Look, thank God, not much anymore, but they still come from time to time. And if I ask them, because sometimes it's the simplest thing that confuses me. And how do I know that my mind... You see, I truly believe that this is a progressive illness. I'll be 34 years sober on the 10th of August. I haven't wanted a drink since the 10th of August, 1984. But I suffer from a progressive illness that centers in the mind, not the body. Centers in the mind. And if I don't pay attention, my mind will take me off into weird and wonderful places one more time. It doesn't take much. Real life emergencies are never anything like what I create in my own head. Ever. The real life emergencies are like, no big thing today. But in my head, I can concoct the most bizarre stories. And I'll just finish with this. How do I know that for sure? The other thing I do, by the way, is, and I've done it for all the years and days I've been sober, I wake up every morning and I ask God to please keep me sober this day and please keep me sane this day. Throughout the day, if I ever feel, and it's only been three or four times in all my years of sobriety, I felt a panic attack coming on. And I just, God. God is all powerful. Without God, I'm nothing. And throughout the day, if I ever feel a little bit uncomfortable, I just talk to God. It's an amazing thing to have that faith. And it's been a gift. It was freely given to me as a gift because I certainly didn't work for it and I certainly didn't deserve it. The other beautiful thing about living this sober life is being able to have a life of meaning and purpose. The meaning and purpose that came from having this hopeless condition of mind and body that other people like me have, and being able to be maybe help or say something that can lift them out of the morass for a little while. And the people around us who really love us, who sometimes say to us, seems like you're indulging in a little self-pity there, Mary, or seems like you're a wee bit depressed today, Mary, and who really care. And I no longer say to them what I used to do in my early days of sobriety. In my early days of sobriety, if you said something like that to me and you weren't my sponsor, I would take it as a criticism. And I would tell you to go and stick it in your ear. Not a spiritual retort, certainly. But today I say thank you, because I know that they care. So it's a gift to get up every day, to keep your life in day-tight compartments. Just day-tight compartments. To live one day at a time, to know that yesterday's gone and tomorrow isn't even born yet, and to know that I will get everything I need for this day if I do what I'm supposed to do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Don Landis, alcoholic.
Absolutely
delighted to be here. What an honor to be sharing the podium with Sheldon and Mari, who are good friends of mine. I've known for a long time. And I don't know if you've noticed a pattern this weekend, but they sure talk about God a lot in AA. Have you noticed that? A lot of chatter about God and steps and sponsorship and working with others and home group. And it's like there's this thread that kind of runs through it. And if you pay attention, you might think maybe they're trying to tell us something. Because this AA is a simple program. And one of the problems that we have, I think, as members of Alcoholics Anonymous is we're selfish and we're self-centered. I certainly am. And I want to make AA something it ain't. And so I think it's important that we understand what AA is and what AA isn't. First thing it isn't, it's not affordable therapy. It's not group therapy, shock therapy, primal scream therapy. It's no form of therapy. It ain't therapy. And I'll tell you the difference between therapy and AA. Because I've done both. I've done some therapy and I love therapy. Because you get to go in there and you get to talk about your favorite subject, me. And I got to go in, I get to talk about my problems. And then if you have a good therapist and you really put some time in, you really put some work in, they'll explain to you why you do what you do when you do it. So the next time you do what you do, when you do it, you'll know why you're doing it. In AA, we have a different plan. We learn to knock it off. And here's the problem. I don't have the power to knock it off. I don't have the power to change my reactions to life. These reactions that seem to be hardwired, where the emotional hoops of life are held up. And I know, I've thought about that. When that happens again, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to do that. I'm in the air halfway through the hoop, and I don't even know I've left my feet. I seem to be not just powerless over alcohol, I seem to be powerless over my thinking. I seem to be powerless over my emotions. And Sheldon so adequately talked about and so perfectly described what happens to guys like us and girls like us, that when we stop drinking, that's when our problems start. That alcohol is my answer. It's my solution. I love the effect produced by alcohol. That's why I drink. What's the effect? It's relief. In a word, it's relief. From what? From what swirls around in my head in a sober state. A constant state of sometimes low anxiety to high anxiety, but it's always there. It's always in the room with me. Always stealing my joy, my serenity, my hope. Something I can't get rid of, like an itch I can't scratch. And it's there with me. And it drives me crazy. And the longer I go without a drink, the worse it gets. And I got to tell you, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, just because I was surrounded by people who had real recovery, who had had the psychic change, who were willing to tell me AA was the best thing that ever happened to them, I still got crazy in AA when I was new. I absolutely went insane right in the middle of you in AA halls. And it was wonderful because people would say things like, you're right where you're supposed to be. But I'm crazy. We know. And they assured me that it was temporary, but they promised me that if you don't want this to last until you pick up your next drink or blow your head off, you're going to have to do some things. And I didn't know what to do. And I got to tell you, here's the good news about AA. AA is very simple. It's monkey see, monkey do, but you got to pick the right monkeys. And I was lucky that I picked the right monkeys, or they picked me. And I seemed to surround myself by the people that were happy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really didn't understand anything about sponsorship, service, steps, any of that. But I understood kindness. And it seemed to me the people that were the kindest to me, that were extending themselves to me, that were actually showing an interest in me, coincidentally were the most active people in Alcoholics Anonymous around me when I got sober. It seemed like the activists were not only the ones that were busier and a moving target's harder to hit kid, they were also the happiest. There was an attractiveness about them that brought me into their fold because they actually seemed like they had an answer to what I was suffering from. And what I was suffering from in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was new was untreated alcoholism in a sober state. And it's brutal. It's the very mechanism that drives guys like me back out to the drink. I don't drink thinking it's going to work the next time. I know it's not going to work. I don't drink to crash a car, go back to jail, ruin a relationship, break my mom's heart one more time. That's not why I drink again. I drink to overcome a mental obsession beyond my human power. I can't take the pain of sobriety. And it's embarrassing and it's shameful. When everybody seemingly your whole adult life has said to you, you shouldn't drink. And you hit a point in your life where you agree with them. You're right. This is awful. This is a waste of life. I wasn't raised this way. I don't want to live this way. Well, you don't think I'm aware of what's happened to me? You don't think I have a front row seat for what I'm enduring on a daily basis? I don't want to live this way. And yet they see us out there drinking again. And it's confusing and baffling to the family. And it's confusing and baffling to the alcoholic. And that's what we're in the grips of. That's the talons of King Alcohol. What has us in his grasp. And what are we going to do about that? How are we going to get sober? And then how are we going to live in sobriety? And I got to tell you, there's a couple of things that through sponsorship, because long before I had a relationship with a loving God, I had a loving God that introduced himself through my sponsor. And he taught me things I would have never come up with on my own. And they're simple things. They're little, tiny. They seem innocuous. They don't seem important at all. Things like showing up a half an hour before a meeting and staying a half an hour late. What does that have to do with the fact I'm hopelessly in debt and I'm living at my sister's house? How is that going to help me? And I don't know how it helped me, but I got sober. And it's little things like going to your sponsor with a big deal. Because I don't know about you when you're new. When I'm new, I have a big deal every single day. It was shocking, my bad luck. Because when I was new, it was happening to me every day. I just run into somebody, some new resentment, some wrongdoing. I grab my sponsor in the club. We got to talk. And he'd say, of course we do. And I'd corner him and I'd tell him about my... And I wore him out. I wore him out, and in a couple of weeks, he was just, God, this guy's neurotic. He's just got something going on every day. And finally, he tells me, he goes, all right, 72-hour rule. I go, 72-hour rule? What's the 72-hour rule? He goes, you're not allowed to talk to me or anybody else about this. You're not even allowed to pray about it. I don't even want God. I don't want God involved in this mess. And he said, and in 72 hours, if this is still a problem, you can come talk to me about it. And I said, okay. And I remember, you know, most of the time, 72 hours, I can't remember. I don't even remember. I'd lay in bed at night and go, oh, I forgot it's been 72 hours. I could have complained. Damn it. Missed the window, you know. One time I go up to my sponsor because I'm going to kill somebody, because I'm always going to kill somebody. Because I'm grandiose, I'm dramatic. I never say I'm upset with somebody I think I should talk to. I'm going to kill him. And he'd say, 72-hour rule. And I go, you don't understand. In 72 hours, I won't be pissed anymore. And I'm completely missing the point of the whole exercise. So it's not sobriety for me, it's slow-briety. I learn these things very slowly, but it's through a sponsor. And I start to go out in the real world, and I'm trying to live, you know, on my safety net. My classroom is Alcoholics Anonymous. I come to AA every night, and you put me back together. Somehow you put me back together. You put me back together through your kindness, through your smiles, through what you share openly and honestly. The gift of identification makes me feel like I'm in the right place. End of an evening of Alcoholics Anonymous when I'm new, I think I could do it one more day. I get up in the morning, I'm insane. I do what my sponsor says. I pray. I don't really meditate. When I'm new, I can't meditate. You know what I mean? If you're going to meditate when you're new, have a pistol close by. You know what I mean? It's just like, doesn't work. The head's too busy. But I say that quick prayer, you know, or I say the third step prayer, and then I go out the front door, you know, and that spiritual guillotine that's there just comes down and severs my conscious contact with God, you know, and then I run on self-will all day long and step on the toes of my fellows, and I'm sober, I'm sorry, and, you know. And I go to AA at night, and you put me back together again, but I'm getting better. I'm getting better every day like this much. I mean, the gap is so small between my fingers, you can't see it, but it's there. It's only in hindsight that you can look back. And it's not big, happy news either. You look back, you're 6 months sober, and you go, well, I'm not as crazy. And I'm not threatening people as often. It's just, it's progress, though. And in AA is the only place I know where they'll applaud that. You know, we haven't had to pull you off anybody in 3 months, kid. You're doing good, you know? Just, only in AA will you get that kind of positive reinforcement, you know? And we need that because you can't go out in the real world and get that with what we suffer from. We need that identification. But you got to go out there in the real world. And it's like going out in the real world sober when you haven't done it in a decade or more. It's like, you know, you stick your toe in the water and then you wait. You wait because I kept thinking they were going to find me out. I thought there's some siren's going to go out. Loser, alcoholic, get out. You know? And what I found out is if I do what my sponsor told me in any situation, they don't know. They don't know. I had horrible jobs early in sobriety. Hated them. Want to quit. They don't know who I am. They don't respect or disrespect me, man. Don't know who I am. Well, they know who you are. My sponsor would say loving spiritual things like, you quit that job, I won't sponsor you. You can't say that. I just did. You know, and just, so I can't quit jobs. I go in, I'm going to kill my foreman. You kill your foreman, I won't sponsor you. So I can't kill my foreman. And then what starts happening? I start keeping jobs. And it's shocking. Because it's a perception thing. It's a perception thing. I think they hate me. I think they're making fun of me. And I know this stuff, you know? I'm working on a project. The project's winding down. They start laying guys off, but they don't lay me off. They're laying more guys off, but they don't lay me off. And finally, it's the final pickup crew. There's three guys left in this giant project that started with 125 guys. It's me and two other guys, the guy that knew nothing. I'm the last guy to leave on that job. And I talked to the foreman about it. Why'd you keep me on? He goes, man, you showed up every day, you had a good attitude, and you worked hard. And I'm like, none of that was true. And then I realized, man, they don't have x-ray vision. As long as I act better than I feel, they don't know it. I start to get valuable information that's going to serve me in the real world. They can't see inside me. I can be crazy. I can feel out of control. I can be afraid. And as long as I don't walk around going, I'm crazy and I'm afraid, they won't know. I found out when people ask you how you are, that's a politeness. It's a nicety. They don't want to know. When I order coffee at Starbucks and the poor little girl, 19-year-old girl, goes, "How's your day?" She doesn't want to know. Let me tell you how it is. I'm feeling less than. You know, I woke up this morning. I don't have a conscious contact with God. I don't think my wife loves me. My sponsor doesn't understand me. I don't know if I'm going to be able to stay sober. I'll have a double mocha. I just don't. You know, she doesn't want to know. Doesn't want to know. You learn to say, "I'm fine. How are you?" You save that stuff for your sponsor. You save it for your sponsor. And I start to live, man. I can start getting better jobs, you know. I remember I was so, God, I'm 3 years sober, and I'm complaining to my sponsor, I'm like, working construction. It's not that I'm not grateful. It's just I'm hopelessly in debt, you know. I'm paying back the IRS, you know, and I'm making barely minimum wage with taxes taken out. And I'm $80,000, and I'm sending them $100. I remember the first check for $100 I wrote the IRS, and I thought, oh, good, $79,900 to go. And now 3 years later, I'm making more money, but it's not great money. And I feel like I'm not great at it. You know what I mean? I've gotten better, but I feel like there's something I'm supposed to be doing. So I do what I've been taught in AA. I go to my sponsor. What do you want me to do? And he goes, "Don, you're a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you show up, you help others, you sponsor guys, you're part of the solution. You know what? God's going to put something in your path. And your job is going to be to say yes to that." And he stopped talking. I go, "That's it?" He goes, "That's it." I thought, he doesn't have an answer. That's that sponsor school they send him to. When they don't know what to say, they bring God in. "Well, God has a plan, kid. And God loves you, but he's not talking. And just because you can't see the path doesn't mean it's not there." And it's, you know, okay, whatever. And 2 weeks later, man, I get this goofy job offer to go interview for this job in an industry I know nothing about, in sales. It's straight commission sales. I've never done that before. It's a loser's game, right? No way I'm going to take this. And this is my best thinking. There's no way. That's not for me. I'm afraid of that. But I've got training in Alcoholics Anonymous, so I don't run my life. See, we turn our will and our life over to the care of God, but I'll tell you what. Most of the letters I get from God, the handwriting looks strikingly familiar. So I've learned to run my thinking by my sponsor. So I pray about it. I'm not supposed to take this job. I'm not supposed to interview for it. I go and I talk to my sponsor. He goes, "I want you to interview." I go, "Man, I don't want to interview." And he stops me and goes, "You know, that's funny. I don't remember asking you what you wanted." And I know where that goes, right? So I interview for the job and they hire me on the spot. Right on the spot. And I am pissed. This should be a happy day. I got the job. I'm so angry. I'm seeing double. I call my sponsor up. I go, "Well, they hired me, smart guy. Now what do we do?" He goes, "Well, you go to work for them." So I go to work for this company, man. They're sliding me $500 a week against commissions I don't have. I'm there for 3 months. I owe the company $5,000. I'm begging my sponsor to quit this job. I go, "Man, the IRS is impatient. We're going in the wrong direction. We need to cut and run, like, now." And he goes, "What's your boss say?" "Ah, they're happy with my efforts. They're saying nobody sells at first. The ship will right itself by the end of the first year, and they really are glad I'm there." He goes, "Well, you get to quit when they stop inviting you back." And I'm thinking, what an idiot. Why is he doing this to me? What did I do to piss him off? And I'm terrible at this job. I'm in sales. I couldn't give something away, let alone sell it. And I'm trying. And what am I trying with? Self-will. Because when I get scared, I go into self-will. So I'm reading sales books. I'm reading every sales book that's ever been published. So every day, I'm trying a different sales technique. So I'm a different guy every day, so I'm neurotic. I'm just out of my mind. I'm trying everything but being myself. You know what I mean? And so I'm going to this job, and I'm just... And this one book I just read, they talked about this sales thing they called instant identification. Right? So you got 5 minutes after you meet somebody to identify with them. So you got to be quick. You know, you look around their house. They got a picture of a fish. What a coincidence. I fish. You know, they got a dog. I love dogs. You know, they got kids. I've always loved kids. You know, something. Vanilla ice cream. What a coincidence. Me too. You know, instant identification. So I'm on this call, right? And it's going great. This lady, you know, nice house, West LA. I get up, I measure a roof, I come down, I'm talking to her, and I'm thinking, instant identification, got to identify. So I look at her, and it's obvious to me that she's pregnant. She's with child, you know, instant identification. So I say to her, I go, "Listen, so how far along are you?" And this appointment was going great, and suddenly everything changed. And her whole face, the smile ran away from her face. She goes, "What do you mean?" And you know, I'm an alcoholic. Anybody with a brain in their head would have dropped the shovel and quit digging. Just quit digging, you know? No, but I'm an alcoholic. I just dig harder. "You're pregnant, aren't you?" And she says, "No."
And the smart part of me says, drop the shovel, quit digging. But no, I'm an alcoholic, I can't give up. Did you have a kid recently? And she says, 2 years ago. I just said, well, thank you for the opportunity to earn your business. And I went back out to my truck and banged my head on the steering wheel going, stupid, stupid, stupid. And called my sponsor up almost in tears about what I had just done. He's laughing so hard he can't get a word out. He finally stammers out, I can't wait to get to the meeting and tell the boys. Because self-pity is not allowed in Alcoholics Anonymous. We will not allow you to feel sorry for yourself. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, and self-pity, right? That's a propulsion system. That's what used to push me through life. Any one of those things is infinitely grave. Any combination can kill me dead. So they don't tolerate self-pity in Alcoholics Anonymous. You learn to laugh at yourself so you never go unamused. How do you live sober? Develop a sense of humor about yourself because we are hilarious. I mean, a day doesn't go by where I go, I don't know how I made it out of the house. I mean, it's just unbelievable how we make it through the world with what we've got to deal with. We are funny. We are hilarious. But if you don't have a sense of humor about it, it'll tear you apart. So I continue on my journey and I move ahead, you know. And it's funny, that job that I was begging my sponsor to quit, you know what? Everything happened just the way it was supposed to. Ship righted itself by the end of the first year. I've been in that industry for over 20 years. You know what's surprising? I'm really, really like that job. And it allowed me to make the kind of living where I could get out of debt, provide for my family, and I'd have missed the whole thing if I had listened to myself. And I talk about sponsorship a lot because I want you to understand I'm not the captain that sailed the ship to this point. It's been my sponsor. Because I've been wrong about everything. My wife, 21 years of marriage, love her like good poetry, luckiest guy. I love my wife so much, sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night and she's sleeping next to me. She's got the cover pulled up to her nose. She likes to sleep that way. She looks just like a little princess sleeping there. And I'll look up at God and I'll go, thanks. You know, I just, that kind of stuff, you know. But none of that. I mean, I remember I went out with her for maybe a month. And I made an appointment with my sponsor to talk about my relationship. Because your sponsors love that. When you call him up and go, I'd like to come over and talk about my relationship. He'll go, good, I'll start cleaning my pistol. That's wonderful. Okay, go ahead. You know. And he goes, what's going on? I said, well, I'm going to break up with Eileen. And he goes, well, what's wrong? I go, nothing. She's perfect. And he goes, well, if she's perfect, why do you want to break up with her? I go, I can't take it. I can't take it, man. I'm crazy in love with her, man. I fell for her like a rock off a boat. I don't like the way it makes me feel, dude. I like it when they're into me, not when I'm into them. This is not comfortable. And he called me a bad name that I can't repeat. And he told me I wanted guarantees. He goes, there's no guarantees in life, and there's no guarantees in love. But I guarantee you this, you don't give it 100%, it's doomed to fail. You got to be willing to give it everything you have and still not have it go the way you want. That's what life's all about. And you know, we're here, and I was ready to call that. And that wasn't just a theory. That wasn't what do you think about it. I was breaking up with this girl after a month. And I would have missed the last 21 years of marriage and probably the sweetest relationship I've ever known. That's my best thinking. You have to understand, that thinking exists today. That thinking is housed inside this gourd you see on top of my neck. It didn't go away. And so I have to use that thing. I have to use the tools of the program. But here's the other problem I see in Alcoholics Anonymous. And to quote my good friend Polly P, she said, AA is a wonderful program and a wonderful place. It'll give you a brand new shiny life and you'll be too busy to do AA. So how do I stay involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and go out there and have a big shiny life like I have? How do I do it? And I got to tell you, and here's the truth of my life. I look back in the last 3 months and what I've done in the last 3 months of my life, and this is what I think. I can't do that. Nobody can keep that pace up. That's insane. That's insane. I look ahead, the next 3 months, what I have on my schedule, and I go, that's bananas. No human being can do that. It's impossible. But here's the thing. Right now, this moment, right here in front of you, us together in this room, you know who else is here with us? God. You know, the only place that I can meet God is in that moment. And coincidentally, it's the only place that I have any chance at all for any manageability in my life is in the moment. You know, in the past where my regret exists, in the future where my fear exists, I can't meet God there. I can only meet Him in the moment. And the moment is always sweet. The moment is that sweet spot I want to get into and I want to stay into. Not just with my feet, but with my thought life. I want to be here, be now, be with you. But how do I stay in AA with this big life, being pulled out in different ways, from business, from family, from all these things, where people say to me all the time, people I know, people I sponsor, Don, I love AA. I love what it's done for me, but I'm busy. I got so much going on at work. You know, it's like that guy on the side of the freeway holding the sign that says, we'll work for food. And I drive by thinking, like, I don't. You know, it's like, we're all busy. But I'll tell you the one thing I've learned to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope this helps you, and it's helped me tremendously, is AA is the only thing in my life that's non-negotiable. I negotiate for a living. That's what I do. I'm a salesman. I negotiate how I'm going to recreate. I negotiate where I live. I negotiate what I do for a living. I negotiate what I'm going to do socially. I negotiate, you know, what I wear. Everything's up for negotiation. Nothing is set in stone. It's written on paper, if that. But everything's up for negotiation. You know what's not up for negotiation? My membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. What does negotiation sound like in Alcoholics Anonymous? Hey, would you like to get on the committee? Let me think about that. Hey, would you come and chair this meeting this month for us? You know, I'd like to say yes, but I got a lot going on. I don't know if I can do that. Or you hear of something, an announcement, and you think to yourself, I should probably do that. That would be good for me. And that little voice in your head goes, yeah, but maybe it won't be fun. And what I do is I negotiate myself out. What if I lived this way? What if I lived that everything that came at me in Alcoholics Anonymous was a divine appointment? What if every newcomer I found in front of me, every opportunity to be of service, everything that I was asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, rather than an inconvenience, what if I looked at it as a divine appointment sent by my Heavenly Father to enhance and enrich my life? How quickly would I say yes to it if I came to believe in that? If I came to believe in the chatter that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous that God really does want me to be happy, joyous, and free, and God really does run AA, how about if everything that comes my way in AA, the operative word, if I can do it, is yes, because it's a divine appointment, and it was created for me in that moment because God loves me. And when you try to live your life that way and you make your AA non-negotiable, I don't have an opinion about AA. If you ask me, are you having fun in AA? I don't know. I'll have to think about it. And I go, yeah, you know what? Come to think of it, I am, because I don't think a lot about those terms. I don't think about what I'd be doing instead, because I love what AA does for me. And I'm always wrong about it. And I'll say this, I'll tell you a quick story, and I'll sit down. Here's a quick story about how I'm wrong about AA. 5 years ago, man, I'm 20 years sober. You know, big deal in my mind. You know, I speak at this meeting, and I'm ready to go home. And this new guy's in line to thank me, you know? And I think he's going to tell me, oh, you changed my life. That was a great talk. And what he says is, can you give me a ride home? And I'm thinking to myself, oh, man, there's people watching. I don't want to give this guy a ride home. I want to go home and get some dinner. It's late already. I got a big day tomorrow. But I'm in AA, and you learn what to say. Well, absolutely, young man. I'd love to give you a ride home. And he lives two counties over. They never live in the same county. So he's two counties over. Now I'm pissed when I find out where he lives, you know, at the halfway house where they got a big screen TV bigger than mine. You know what I mean? So I get him in the car and I'm driving him to the halfway house and I'm bitter, I got to tell you, you know, and I'm thinking about work tomorrow and I'm thinking about how late I'm going to be and am I still going to be able to get some dinner and watch some ESPN, have some quality dining time before I go to bed, but I'm fulfilling my obligation. You know, he's talking. And when somebody's talking, then you got to talk and he's talking, I'm talking. And without my permission, I start to identify with him. And I start to care about him. And we pull up in front of the halfway house. And before we pulled up, man, 15 minutes earlier, I'm thinking maybe I'll slow down to 5, 10 miles an hour and just give him a good roll down the street, just curve him right into the driveway. I don't even want to stop. And now I stop the rig and I shut the engine down. And now there's no work tomorrow. There's no ESPN. There's no dinner. Because now what's happened is in a very short amount of time, I actually care about this young man. I've turned to him and I'm interested and I'm talking to him. And I find things coming out of my mouth I can't believe, because the guy who felt inconvenienced 40 minutes earlier is saying, how are you going to get to the meeting tomorrow night? I really want to see you there. Would you mind if I came and picked you up? And something happens very quickly because God was in that car between me and the newcomer and I didn't know it. And if I let God into the car, I think I'm letting the newcomer in, but I'm letting God come in because he's right with that newcomer. And I drop him off, you know, and then I'm driving home. And now it's 1 o'clock in the morning. And I've missed my dinner and I've missed ESPN. And it's going to be a long day tomorrow. And I'm so happy I can't get the grin off my face. And I'm driving home from a divine appointment in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm thinking, I wonder what the little people are doing tonight. Because I'm living large in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I make AA non-negotiable. It served me well for over 25 years. I'm here to stick with the winners. And who are the winners?
Are they the ones with the most time? Not necessarily. As Clancy says, they are the ones that are currently doing the deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the activists. They've never steered me wrong. I've been having a very good time loving my sobriety. And I know that's available to each and every one of us. Thanks.